Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The highest profile race in Pennsylvania in next Tuesday's midterm election is for governor of the Commonwealth. There are four candidates on the ballot, including incumbent Democrat Tom Wolf, who is seeking a second term. The man who wants to unseat him is Republican Scott Wagner of York County. Scott Wagner joins us today. Senator Wagner, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Let me start with a basic question. Why are you running for governor?
Well, if I look back to 2013, when I made a decision to run for the state Senate, representing the 28th Senate District, the reasons haven't changed. I was fed up with Harrisburg, being treated as a second-rate citizen, as a business owner, made a decision to run for that Senate seat, ended up winning a write-in campaign in 2014. And I've been in Harrisburg as a senator for a little over 4 years. Harrisburg is completely broken and dysfunctional. And Governor Wolf is a failed governor. And Harrisburg actually is worse. And I've watched it. I've had an opportunity to sit on the front row of the Senate and watch Harrisburg become more dysfunctional and more out of control over the last 4 years. Thus, my decision to run. And as I travel around the state this year, for example, last night, I think I cracked my 734th event for the year. Last year, I had 380. So I'm all over Pennsylvania talking to people. And it's very clear we have a lot of issues in Pennsylvania, and we've got to solve these issues. We also have opportunities. But people of Pennsylvania want something different. They want a leader. They want someone who is going to fight for them, someone who is going to be their champion, and that's what's motivating me every day. I've met thousands of people across Pennsylvania really over the last 4 years. That's what motivates me, and that's why I'm doing it.
What are the big differences between you and Governor Wolf?
Well, the difference, it's very, very clear. It's night and day. Governor Wolf was born into an affluent family in York, Pennsylvania. And, he was a sixth generation business owner. And I have a lot of respect for any business that gets to the sixth generation. Typically, a lot of businesses don't survive past the second or third. He went to a private school, went off to college, spent time in the Peace Corps, and just he's a very different mindset. And his goals and objectives are very different. I grew up on a farm in York, Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a blue-collar family. Our family didn't have a lot of money, but we worked hard, and my mother gave horseback riding lessons for over 50 years. And while it wasn't a working farm, we baled hay on neighboring farms every single summer. I mean, I could bale hay in my sleep if I wanted to. But I learned the value of hard work, and I learned, responsibility. We had a lot of animals. Animals need to be fed on a schedule like everybody else. And so the difference is, and I've started several companies from scratch. I've started two waste companies with two trucks. I've driven the trucks, started them, and have grown them to fleets of over 100 vehicles. So I have a very different background where I've started things from scratch. High school graduate, 1 year of college. I'm a blue-collar person, and I always will be a blue-collar person. And I would say that 70 to 80% of the people in Pennsylvania, at the end of the day, when you really peel back the layers of the onion, they're blue-collar also. So there's a big difference.
But, okay, you have different backgrounds. You've grown up differently, different lives. But why is it a big difference? What does that mean to voters? Why does it make a difference to voters?
Well, number one, right now, Governor Wolf is proud that we have more people in Pennsylvania on public assistance. We have more people, receiving food stamps. He's proud of that. But the reality in Pennsylvania, we have between 200 and 400,000 skilled labor positions that are open. And we need to fill those positions with qualified workers. So why don't we train people that are on public assistance and help them become a productive part of society? Governor Wolf comes from a background where he's very liberal. He just believes that government should take care of people. And that's okay that, back in the 1950s, if you can envision a wagon and you had 100 people pulling the wagon and you had two on the wagon, well, that's now changing a lot. We now have close to 50, 60 on the wagon, and we have 40 people pulling the wagon. And, case in point, just recently, the House and Senate passed a work requirement bill, piece of legislation to the governor that would require able-bodied people that are receiving public assistance from the state of Pennsylvania to work a certain number of hours each week. We're not talking 40 hours. We're talking probably under 10 hours a week. But able-bodied people are being asked to work. The governor vetoed that bill. And so, you know, it is not a healthy society when you have more and more people that are on public assistance and the government is taking care of those people. We want people to be able to take care of themselves. We want them to better their lives. So there's a complete different mindset.
Can I interrupt for just one second? Because you're using the term public assistance. But one thing I want to point out is a recent proposal would be that, for context purposes, Pennsylvania is one of the states that expanded Medicaid. And we're one of 33 states, I think, now, that you, I think, initially didn't support that, but you do now. And you have said that you would support continuing that expansion for 4 years. But just to point that out as context, that you would require people who are receiving Medicaid benefits that they would be required to work.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we're talking able-bodied. And listen, I heard a story last night. I was in Westmoreland County at a rally, and a man came up to me and told me a story of, you know, a benefit that I hadn't heard of before, but the benefit allows somebody to go out and buy a certain amount of toiletries every so often. Well, this person went and received these toiletries and then went to Walmart and said, I'd like to return these. I don't have a receipt. And they ended up giving him cash for those toiletries and healthcare items that were purchased from a government program. Listen, we hear stuff like this all the time. People see it. They witness it. People are getting tired of it. But at the end of the day, I want to help people become productive parts of society. There are people that need help. You know, there are people recently, I had the opportunity to tour a company called Pride Mobility up in the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area, and they make power chairs. Well, they have a product, a chair that really will elevate. It could elevate up to 6 feet. So that person could be sitting in that power chair, and I could be standing up, and they can raise that chair up so that we have equal eye contact. And if you talk to some people that are, you know, in a disability situation, that are in maybe in wheelchairs or power chairs, if you talk to some of those people, they would love to work. Okay, they would love to be able to go somewhere, and they don't want to sit home all the time. They would like to work. But this piece of equipment, as I've learned and I've watched it, is changing the lives of many people. If you go to Lowe's in York, Pennsylvania, there's a young man, his name is Chris Veseth, and he has worked at Lowe's out in East York for over 20 years. And he is, I don't know what his physical disability is, but he's in a wheelchair. You walk in, you have never in your life run into a more pleasant person. He knows where every screw, light bulb, fixture, 2x4, he knows it all. He's a wonderful guy. And so there are people like that out there, but if they had the equipment, and listen, a lot of companies have call centers. And, you know, people, if there was an opportunity to employ those people. Listen, I'm about bringing people back to work, making them productive. But we can't have government's not role isn't to take care of people all the time.
Would you support the government paying for or helping to pay for that piece of equipment you're talking about?
In some situations, yes. And I would say I would. And there, you know, potentially an employer would participate. Maybe there's some tax credits, there's actual grant money. Yes, absolutely. Because that person over time can earn money and can become a person that is part of our society and is working. And there are a lot of people that want to do that. And I think so. I'm a Republican, people think I'm a cold-hearted guy. Listen, I have a lot of compassion for people. And, you know, I employ hundreds of people and I want to help people. I want to see people do better. And I think, you know, that's the difference. There's a mindset that Republicans were bad and, you know, it's all about the dollar. It's not about the dollar. It's about I want to help people. And as I crisscross Pennsylvania and I meet people all over Pennsylvania, people want optimism. They want somebody who takes time and learns about, you know, their issues. And you were asking me about Governor Wolf and the difference. You know, Governor Wolf doesn't do town hall meetings. He only did one debate, which, you know, the debate was in Harrisburg. I mean, actually, the governor sat on the sidelines while I ended up debating Alex Trebek. But at the end of the day, Tom Wolf is not in any setting where he is going out and talking to the people. I was at a rally last night with 150 to 200 people. They asked me questions, and I'm very comfortable doing that. But Governor Wolf isn't out on the street, and he hasn't been out on the street for almost 4 years doing any town hall meetings where people can ask him questions. He deflects. He leaves. That's not a leader. That's somebody who's, you know, he's scared of facing his customers.
Let's talk about personality. Something that has become an issue in the campaign is your personality.
Correct.
And temperament. You said that you're a blue-collar guy. You've been called brash. I think you probably would agree with that. A few weeks ago, you produced a video where you said you would stomp on the governor's face wearing golf spikes. The governor responded with a commercial that said you are unhinged and not fit for office. How do you respond to that?
Well, number one, that video was about 2.5 minutes. And what Governor Wolf took in his campaign was about 6 to 7 seconds. Number one, people said I was yelling and I seemed angry. No, I was standing along I-83 where there were tractor trailers going by, and I was trying to make sure that my voice was at a certain level. But you also didn't see the billboard behind me. And the billboard was Penn Waste, had a picture of me. Penn Waste sues its customers. And listen, if you're in business, you have to collect your money. These billboards are all over South Central Pennsylvania. So, you know, I have a little bit of a problem with Tom Wolf coming to my town, his Democrat friends, and tearing down a 40-year reputation that I've built up. There are over 400 people that work at Penn Waste. It's an insult to those people also. But I'm going to say this, and probably maybe I shouldn't. Listen, if you punch me, I'm going to punch you back. And this is a nasty, nasty game. I've been called a lot of things. And so, you know, I'm not unhinged at all. I know what I want to do. I have a strong personality. I'm not a sissy, and I'm not going to back down. And that's what the people of Pennsylvania want. They want somebody who's going to stand up for them. You know, for example, we're dealing with what's going on in Pittsburgh is the absolute tragedy. Words cannot express what happened in Pittsburgh this past Saturday. 11 people were assassinated. Governor was on a radio talk show yesterday. He didn't want to talk about the death penalty. He put a moratorium on the death penalty. Listen, I think the death penalty is very appropriate for the animal that walked into that synagogue and massacred and assassinated those 11 people. The governor doesn't believe that. Governor believes that the person, like, for example, on stage a month ago, the governor said on stage at the Hershey Hotel that Eric Freen, who assassinated a state trooper up in Pike County, Trooper Brian Dixon, assassinated him like he was shooting an animal. He believes that he should sit in jail and rot. And listen, you know, Eric Freen deserves the death penalty, and so does the man out in Pittsburgh. They deserve fast and swift. But meanwhile, Eric Freen is sitting on death row in a prison in Pennsylvania getting 3 square meals a day, having heat. He has TV. He probably has internet access. He has stuff that other people don't have that are out working. And Governor Wolf is a coward, and he does not stand behind victims and victims' families. And so there is a clear, clear difference between Governor Wolf and myself. And I believe that there should be consequences. You know, Governor Wolf thinks that everybody should get candy no matter what they've done.
Just want to get back to the personality part and temperament, though. We will go on to other issues that voters want to hear about. But probably the concern is that if you were governor, you would make a rash decision based on emotions, based on your anger at the time.
Listen, I don't think I'm not an angry person. I'll use the word upset before I use the word angry. Listen, I'm compassionate, and I'm not Casper Milquetoast. And if people want Casper Milquetoast, then just go in and pull the lever for Governor Wolf, because you got Casper Milquetoast. The difference is, and I don't make rash decisions. And if people did some research, listen, I didn't build companies over the last 40 years. I have very few people in the senior management side of my company that I don't have management turnover, because I respect those people and they respect me and we work together. If you go around the Capitol, if anybody took the time, and no one has done this, if you walked around the Capitol and you interviewed people throughout the Capitol and asked this question, tell us about Scott Wagner. What was he like over the last little over 4 years? You'd be shocked at some of the answers you get. You'll never hear he's a wild man. You'll hear, you know, Scott Wagner came up here and he's changed the culture. And Scott Wagner has asked questions And, you know, he has uncovered a lot of the shortcomings of Harrisburg. We haven't seen a wild man at all. We've seen somebody who's very passionate. Do I get red faced when I talk? Yeah, I do. But at the end of the day, I'm not a crazy guy, but people want somebody that's got some backbone, and I have backbone, and I'm not a coward, and I'm going to do the right thing for the people of Pennsylvania.
I have talked to some people, colleagues of yours in your party, who said that there were times in caucus, behind closed doors, where they were afraid to open their mouth because they thought that you would respond, that maybe you would go into with TV commercials campaigning against them.
Oh, that would never happen. Well, number one, if those people felt that way, they shouldn't be in the Senate. Actually, I had someone in the Senate tell me that they were afraid to speak up. You're an elected representative of the people, and we've had some great discussions in caucus. But the fact I would never run for them to ever think, listen, they're Republicans, to ever think I'd run TV commercials is
absolutely. But you did that against a former majority leader.
Well, I didn't run TV commercials against the former majority leader. Listen, when I ran my write-in campaign, the Senate Republican Campaign Committee spent $1 million trying to beat me and smear me right out of the gate. And guess who spent $500,000 of his own money? Dominic Pileggi. And when I got to Harrisburg, you know, people keep scratching their heads and asking this question. We had a Republican governor, Governor Corbett. We had a majority House and Senate. You didn't get anything done. Well, I was there probably in the first 4 to 6 weeks, and I was in a meeting with Senator Pileggi, and he made a comment. You know, somebody talked about, well, you know, Governor Corbett, and his response was, I'm not doing Governor Corbett any favors. I mean, I'm like, wait a minute, you're a Republican? So you know what? People, if they're not performing, and they're going to get called out. Listen, this is like being on the board of GM. If you can't stand the heat, you should get out of the kitchen, quite frankly, because this is, remember, you are representing, overall, the full Senate, we represent about 13 million Pennsylvanians. And we have a lot of problems because people have been unwilling to deal with those problems over the years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest this morning is Scott Wagner, the Republican candidate for governor. WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. Senator Wagner, in 25 minutes, we can't get in depth with many issues, so I'll ask, what are the three or four main issues that you see as priorities, issues that you would want to tackle on day one?
Well, I think let's talk about three. Jobs in the economy. People want secure jobs, and they want a secure economy. We are not enjoying the renaissance or the vibrancy of the national economy. Why? Because we have far too many regulations. We have 200,000 to 400,000 skilled labor positions. And we also, if we can work with businesses a lot closer, and we can look at some of the regulations, we can roll back some of the burdensome regulations, it will allow businesses to be more prosperous. And if they're more prosperous and they make more money, and they can pay more, they can pay higher wages, and they can have, they can also continue to sustain the trajectory of paying for healthcare costs. I mean, healthcare costs have gone up dramatically. So we're talking about jobs in the economy. But one of my large priorities when I cross the river is to go to zero-based budgeting in Harrisburg. People say, what's zero-based budgeting? Well, zero-based budgeting is being done by most people at their kitchen tables. You sit down, you look at your income, and you look at your expenses. And so if you get, husband and wife are sitting there and they get four paychecks each a month, they know what their total income is, they know what their expenses are. And so we're going to go to zero-based budgeting, and we're going to bounce the checkbook in Harrisburg. And I'm a business guy, and I can tell you the checkbook in Harrisburg has not been balanced for probably 30 to 35 years or even more. So we're going to focus on that. We're going to focus on education. And education is a component of filling those 200,000 to 400,000 skilled labor positions. Not every student is college material. And I think we waste a tremendous amount of time and effort pushing students into college. They come out with liberal arts degrees. They come out with a lot of student debt. And then they can't get a job that pays more than about $40,000. But meanwhile, You know, students that are graduating from high school going to Thaddeus Stevens to become a machinist or a welder, coming out with a 2-year certificate or degree and starting at $65,000 or more, and not a lot of student debt. So we really need to focus. Education is the cornerstone, really, of everything. And you know, when I've been spending a lot of time in Philadelphia, and I recently attended a church service in Philadelphia, and there was a phrase that came out of that service, and it was on the church bulletin. It said, "It is easier to build a child than it is to repair an adult." So we need to spend a lot of time on the front end working with students. We need to talk to kids when they're 4th, 5th, and 6th grade instead of waiting until they're 10th, 11th, and 12th talking about their future. But education is everything. So, you know, but to pay for education, we need to continue to balance our checkbook because education is expensive. And you know, we have to focus on this. And that will help our job security, help our economy. You know, I talked a little bit about regulations. We have over 153,000 regulations in the state of Pennsylvania. It's choking businesses. And I'm not talking about trashing regulations. There are regulations that overlap. And we need to get to the bottom of those regulations. And there are a lot of permits that are applied for with various agencies that should be approved in 30 to 45 days, and sometimes they take 6 months, a year, and sometimes even longer.
Name me a regulation that sticks in your craw, one that, day one, that you would want to repeal.
Well, number one...
You can't do that, but I understand that.
We have to go through every single regulation, but I can tell you right now, of the 153,000 regulations, there are 208 or 209 regulations on the design, safety, use, and operation of ladders. Now, cut me a break. We need to go through all the regulations, and we need to put together most likely a legislative task force and go through every single one. Have some people from the House and Senate, both parties, you know, work in a group with some business people and literally go through each regulation. And there's a lot of reporting that is required that businesses have to report to Harrisburg. Well, I'd like to know who reads all these reports. Is it just, you know, clogging up a computer system? You know, some of it has to be done, you know, in paper form. But listen, even though I was in the Senate, I only had access to 50% of the information. People think because you're a senator or a House member, you have access and so much latitude and power. That's not accurate. And the problem we have right now is that I'm a more hands-on operations person. Governor Wolf is a master delegator. He has appointed 30 agency secretaries, and he basically gave each agency secretary the keys to the office and said, go run the place. And there's no oversight. So, you know, I can tell you that DEP and PennDOT are still taking a lot longer, and actually longer than over the last 4 years, to issue permits, highway occupancy permits, traffic light permits. You know, everything requires a traffic study. So there's a lot of things that we have to look at. And then finally, I want to talk about the largest crisis in the state of Pennsylvania, and it's a nationwide crisis, and that is the heroin opioid crisis. And just 2 days ago, in the Monday edition of Penn Live, or the Patriot paper, they reported that the number of deaths has increased 56% from 2015 to 2017. Governor Wolf issued a state of emergency. I mean, like, what's that all about? The death rate is getting worse. And I'll tell you, I have an opioid addiction, heroin addiction crisis plan. And the afternoon, next Wednesday morning, when I'm the governor-elect, I'm going to be announcing a drug crisis summit that's going to be held on the 26th or 27th of this month, of next month. And we are going to probably bring in district attorneys, coroners, people from the treatment community, people from law enforcement, you know, people that are recovering addicts, and people that are, you know, are families of victims. We're going to bring probably several hundred people together and talk about what they see as solutions, because those are the people you have to talk to. If I talk to a district attorney out in Westmoreland County, he's got a lot of ideas. If I talk to a district attorney in Luzerne County, he's got ideas. We need to bring all the ideas together, and then you need a governor who's going to execute on those ideas.
I want to follow up on a couple of those issues, and we only have a few minutes left, so I'll try to do this as quickly as I can. Zero-based budget, and you compared it to how a family decides on its own budget. On paper, that sounds great. So the first question I have to ask is, why hasn't it been done before? But we're talking about, and you've compared state government running it like a business, $33 billion business. That's huge. There are programs that continue from year to year to year. So how is it? Is it possible to start at zero and ramp up to this $33 billion budget?
Absolutely, it is. Listen, the reason we haven't ever done zero-based budgeting, because no one has the business background that I have ever that's been in the governor's office. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've started businesses from scratch. And listen, most business people in Pennsylvania, there are 975,000 businesses in Pennsylvania, and a lot are small businesses. I would consider, I'm not IBM or U.S. Steel. I'm a small business. I walk around every single day in my company with a putty knife and scrape pennies off the floor. Why can't Harrisburg do that? Listen, we wasted $1 billion on a statewide radio system from 2006 to 16. Do you hear anybody screaming about that? No. Listen, in 2016, one of the best years in the stock market, in the PSERS pension fund, which is the Pennsylvania School Employee Retirement System, teachers pension fund, educators, we had almost $50 billion in that fund. The benchmark goal that year was 7.5%. And remember, 2016 was a really good year in the market. The actual return was 1.29%. We paid money managers $416 million to deliver a squat. So what are we doing about it? Nothing. Did we fire the money managers? Probably not. The treasurer just came out with a report in the last 60 days that the state of Pennsylvania overpaid money managers $5.5 billion over a 10-year period. Do you hear anybody screaming about that? See, that's where you're going to see me. That's where you're going to see me get a little wild and crazy, because I'm going to be beating on the table saying this needs to stop. We're going to fire these money managers, and we're going to hire money managers that are going to bring us responsible returns. And it is doable. There are money managers. But here's the problem. When I got to Harrisburg in 2014, there were 343 money managers. Why is that? Because of political favors and contributions. We should have probably less than 10 money managers. Just this last week, the people managing those funds, they can't make up their mind whether they want to bring the funds together or not bring them together. And, you know, we have people that are making decisions over in Harrisburg that those decisions and the issue they're talking about is beyond their skill set. And so that's the problem over here. So I'm going to bring we're going to look at everything. And there are a lot of programs that are very, very important, but we want to make sure that every program that is funded is measurable and is successful. And if we can't measure it and we can't measure and see success, then we need to look at that program.
Scott Wagner, we're almost out of time. I always like to allow candidates a minute, to leave a message with voters. What would that be?
Well, the message with voters is, number one, you're going to get a very different politician. I'm not a career politician. I have no interest in being one. I'm 63 years old. My wife and I have made a commitment to do this for 8 years. I'll be 71 years old. And I'm not politically correct, and I'm not trying to be politically correct. I'm going to tell you the way I see it. I'm not going to sugarcoat things. But I can tell you that the people of Pennsylvania are going to have somebody who is going to be a leader. And I'm not going to be sitting on the bench. I'm not going to be a governor who's going to be sitting in my office waiting for the House and Senate to send bills. One of my top agenda items is to eliminate school taxes on everybody's home in Pennsylvania. I mean, we have 4.5 million households in Pennsylvania. Probably 20% are seniors. Every senior I talk to is complaining that they either have to borrow money to pay their school taxes, or, you know, they have to do without, and some are selling their homes, some are losing their homes to sheriff sales or tax upset sales. The bottom line is, I'm going to be a very different governor. I'm a determined person. I know what needs to be done, and I'm going to get it done, period.
Scott Wagner, Republican for governor of Pennsylvania, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and we're going to make a hard turn here. We went from talking about gubernatorial politics, the election, which is a very important election next Tuesday, to what's very important to a lot of people, and that is today, Halloween. There will be a lot of trick-or-treaters around the state tonight, a lot of people celebrating Halloween, and as part of that holiday, I guess you would say, we always talk about ghosts, goblins, monsters, vampires and all that, but, you know, there will be ghost stories today and tales of houses being haunted. But what's the difference? And are ghosts real? Joining us is Dr. Rich Robbins. He's an Associate Dean of Arts and Science at Bucknell University and a certified parapsychologist. Dr. Robbins, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and happy Halloween.
And happy Halloween to you, too. As a parapsychologist, are you the most popular guy on the block this time of year?
Yeah, you know, I am pretty much. When we start advertising and marketing some of the presentations I do at Bucknell and in the area, I'm popular on campus and I'm popular by phone as well. So once people get wind of my interest and my background, I get some calls, and they'll last probably for the next couple of weeks after Halloween as well.
So what is a parapsychologist?
So a parapsychologist is, so a parapsychologist is someone who uses scientific principles to study anomalous events, what people might call paranormal events. And parapsychology is a very wide area. It includes, but it's not limited to, things like ESP, extrasensory perception, ghosts and hauntings, cryptozoology, like the mythical animals that people feel might be out there, like Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster. But my kind of sub-area within parapsychology is ghosts and hauntings. So parapsychologists utilize scientific methodology to study these strange phenomena to determine whether they're real or not.
You know, we talked a week or so ago and had a good conversation about, you know, what you talk to people about, you know, because there are a lot of people who will come to you and say, oh, I saw a ghost. They probably tell their story to you. And, you know, to that person, that ghost was real, and what they saw, you couldn't tell them anything differently. But that's not how you look at it. You don't look at it as you're here today to say whether ghosts are real or not. But let me ask you that question. Here it is, just like the people on the street. Are they real?
So what I say and what I believe and what the research suggests, the scientific research, is that people do have these events and these experiences. I'm not saying they don't, and I've had such experiences in my life as well, and I'm not saying that ghosts don't exist, but what I'm saying as a scientist who studies this is that in order to say that it is truly something paranormal, supernatural, a ghost, a soul, a spirit, you have to rule out every possible natural possibility, whether it's environmental affecting the person or something within the person affecting them, resulting in these experiences and perceptions. So again, I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm just saying that we need to rule all possibilities out instead of jumping right away to the conclusion that it's ghosts.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and you know, we don't know everything as humans, even though we think we do. We do not know everything, and maybe 50, 100 years from now, we'll have the scientific methodology and the instruments to actually measure and determine that things are actually ghosts. But right now, you need to rule out every possibility, and that has not been done yet.
By the way, I want to say to our audience that if you would like to weigh in on this conversation, maybe you've had an experience, a ghostly experience yourself, I want to tell that story. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, when you say that we haven't ruled out other explanations for what people may have seen or witnessed or felt in their lives, for example, you said environmental reasons. What are some of those other possibilities that people don't consider? Because I imagine a lot of times people are acting from emotion. It's not something they normally see or witness. So what are the possibilities that they don't think about?
Right. So environmental factors could be things as common as magnetic fields that are all around us, and with the increase in technology and the use of things such as cell phones, cell towers, all the wireless technology, these magnetic fields have increased recently in our lifetime. Magnetic fields can have an effect on the temporal lobe of the brain and other parts of the brain and cause sensations of dread, of being watched. Extreme electromagnetic fields can cause sensations of hallucinations, of feelings on the skin, like something's crawling on your skin, auditory hallucinations. So it could be something as simple as a magnetic field. And so when you hear about ghost hunters and they use these electromagnetic field detectors, there probably are high levels of magnetic energy in the environment when people have these experiences. But that doesn't mean it's a ghost. It could be the natural magnetic field in the environment. Another very popular and more recently discovered phenomena is infrasound, which is sound below what we can detect as humans, but it still affects our physiology. So infrasound can cause our eyeballs to vibrate, can cause the nerves in our inner ear to vibrate, and send messages to our brain that can result in sensations and perceptions that may or may not actually be there. And people, as I said, are unaware of this because we can't really hear it, but it's out there. And in fact, these commercial haunted houses that are popular this time of year use infrasound machines to induce this type of feeling in people who go through their haunted houses.
Oh, you just ruined the experience for a lot of people, you realize.
Well, I do, but again, I'm not saying that it's not a ghost or a haunting, and I'm not saying that, you know, these things don't happen. I'm just saying it's probably incorrect to jump to the conclusion right away that it is a ghost.
What would have to happen to prove to you that ghosts do exist?
Okay. So, yeah, there are two possibilities through scientific methodology. One would be that the team who is investigating such things would have to have the knowledge base to rule out any possible causes. So you would have to have somebody like a physiologist who can measure the person's physiological reactions, a psychologist who has information on this person's background, an architect if you're indoors to study the architecture of the building, a physicist to determine if there is electromagnetic waves affecting you. So a bunch of scientific people with knowledge to say, okay, it's not A, it's not B, it's not C, it's not D. We've ruled out all possibilities. So that's one way. The other way would be if you're in a controlled setting, like a true scientific experiment, and the phenomena were to occur in a setting where all these other factors are controlled for and don't play a role in the event. So those, according to the scientific methodology, those would be the two ways to pretty much prove that it is something out of the ordinary, something supernatural.
Why hasn't that happened up until now? I mean, you're only talking about five people, and a television network could put that together pretty easily. Why hasn't that happened?
Right. Well, there was a study done about 8-9 years ago at Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, which is considered one of the most haunted areas in the country, if not the world, where they had such a team of experts, and they actually discovered, well, not discovered, but they were one of the early folks to identify infrasound. And so the conclusion there was that infrasound is not only occurring in that structure, but the architecture of that structure causes the infrasound to amplify, and spread throughout the whole institution, the whole building. And that could probably cause at least some of the experiences people have. But I think it's because parapsychology is not yet accepted as a mainstream scientific endeavor. Because when people say parapsychology, the scientific community shuns it, so to speak. And even though you're studying things scientifically, they still see it as a pseudoscience or a fake science, and it's studying things that aren't real.
Our guest is Dr. Rich Robbins, Associate Dean of Arts and Science at Bucknell University. He's a certified parapsychologist. If you have a story to tell, maybe you've experienced something you couldn't explain. Maybe you think you saw a ghost. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send us, you could do this on Twitter as well. If you can do it in 280 characters or less, tell your story. And I don't know, I think the phone would probably, we'd get your emotions and your fright a little bit better than if you did it on paper or on a computer. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call on this Halloween. Now, one of the things that you talk about, Dr. Robbins, is that the difference between ghost and hauntings.
Right.
What is the difference?
So, and this is strictly based on parapsychological nomenclature and terminology. So a ghost is considered to be, if they exist, considered to be the soul of a deceased person, the spirit of a deceased person, that it is actually some leftover energy from a deceased person that's in the environment that is aware of itself and can interact with you. So when people can react and react to a ghost and they react back or to the phenomena, that would be considered a ghost or a spirit. A haunting is considered technically a residual haunting, which is basically the theory that the environment has recorded an event, and this event is replayed over and over throughout time. So, for example, soldiers marching across Gettysburg's battlefield, someone hearing somebody walk across their attic the same time every night, hearing a baby crying at the same time every day in your house, and the baby isn't there. These things are theorized to be somehow the event was so emotional and gave off so much energy that the environment somehow recorded it. And so the environment is actually the media that plays back this recording over and over and over. And these aren't intelligent hauntings. They are considered just experiences of the past that come into our dimension and we can experience them. So a ghost is the soul of a deceased person that can interact with you. A haunting is more of a recording in the environment.
I understand that your home was reportedly haunted.
Yes.
What happened?
So when I was a child, I grew up in a town, Bloomsburg, which is not far from where I am now. And the local lore, in a nutshell, was that a person was robbing graves across the street from where we lived. We lived across the street from a cemetery, which always helps, and ran into the house that my parents eventually bought. And instead of giving himself up to the authorities, he hung himself in the basement. Now, that was never verified by any records, but that was the local folklore. So growing up, between the ages of 2 and 15, I lived in that house. And growing up, we would experience things such as in the middle of the night when everybody's in bed, hearing cupboards in our kitchen downstairs open and close. And we would go downstairs, and the cupboards would be open or half open or some open and some closed. There were times when we would leave for the evening, the whole family would be gone together, and we would come back, and tables and chairs from our dining room, that the chairs would be pulled out from the tables, and nobody was in the house. There were times when the old-fashioned television sets that you actually had to get up and move and turn the dial, we would be watching TV, and the dial would switch to a different channel while we were all sitting there watching it. There were episodes of fruits and vegetables moving through the house with nobody around. My mother claimed to have seen an apparition. My brother claimed to have heard voices. So just a lot of strange things growing up in that house.
But yet you still want some proof that, I don't know, what did you want proof of after experiencing all those things?
So growing up, I believed 100% in ghosts, and I believed our house was haunted, and it wasn't until, for lack of a better term, that I got educated, and I learned, through my education and college and grad school, the scientific methods and all the possible things that could affect perceptions, and because my background is psychology, that I decided, I started thinking about, well, there are other possibilities, and maybe it was a ghost, maybe it wasn't a ghost, but again, I would have to rule out all possibilities. So I think it was my education of the scientific methodology and the realization that so many things affect our everyday experiences and affect our behaviors and our perceptions that led me to the place I am today of being more agnostic than a true believer.
Let's take some phone calls. Barbara is in York. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to phone in two experiences I've had, and I also have an 11-year-old son who seems to be sensitive. When my father died in 2012, he died at 3:20 a.m., and that same day we were at the funeral home making arrangements, and I got a call from home that my sensitive son was playing on the floor in the living room next to an antique tabletop grandfather clock that I had not wound in years, and all of a sudden things started chiming, and when you looked at the time, it read the time of death for my dad.
Wow.
And it ran for about 10 minutes and then it stopped. The other experience I had, I lived in Baltimore City in a house that by the time we left was 92 years old, and particularly as we were packing to move, and it was a very stressful time, it seemed to kick up activity in the home, and there was a lot of things that my son was experiencing. So I found a minister who was willing to do a blessing which was actually a hard thing to arrange. I found that I got a lot of not returned phone calls when I asked for help with that. But one day I found a minister who said she'd do a blessing. She was scheduled to come a few days later. And after I left meeting her, I went home, I had a cold, I took a nap, and in the middle of my nap, I heard a very loud noise, like a cartoon version of a spring, like a boing, and broke through this noise of a very clear female voice who said, well, that's what you get for living where you're not wanted.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. And we only have a few minutes, so I'm going to try to ask a couple quick questions here. A great story. Sure. But a couple points she brings up. She said her son was more sensitive. Are there some people who are more sensitive than others to this?
There are. Again, this is all theoretical because it's not proven, but there are theories out there that suggest that children, because they're not as socialized as adults are and are more open to experiences, tend to be more sensitive. There are other theories that because of the physiological makeup of a person, their brain, their sense of perception, which senses are heightened in what situations, that some people may be more adept at experiencing these things than others. So you could have two people in the same room, one person having an experience and the other one not, because the first person is more sensitive in physiological and psychological ways to such experiences. So it could absolutely, if these theories are true and can be proven, it could be that some people are more sensitive and pick up these experiences, whether supernatural or not. What I found interesting was her comment about the difficulty in getting the house blessed. It's not like you see on these TV shows where they say they found a priest, they blessed the house, and the thing ended. It's not something that can easily be resolved in a half an hour or an hour, as she experienced.
Let's go to Linda in Hershey. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
I've got a lot of situations in my life that I absolutely believe in spiritual connection, but as far as actually seeing something, once in my life I've seen not what I expected. You'd think this to see a white ghostly spirit.
Casper.
I actually saw a black apparition, and it was shortly after my brother died, and it woke me out of a sleep, and I saw it kind of like floating down the hallway. And I felt it was probably a connection somehow to that experience.
Hey, thank you very much for your call, and I hate to sound like I'm hurrying people, but we do only have about 2 minutes left. Okay, so what Linda described there, I mean, again, I think many people expect when they're talking about this that we see the Casper-like, cartoon-like white ghost. Yeah. What do most apparitions look like?
Actually, it's very rare to see a full-body apparition. Most people sense a ghost through either a feeling that they're being watched or somebody's there, or maybe what people would call the beginning of the formation of an apparition, so maybe a mist. I'm reluctant to talk about orbs because there's no scientific proof that orbs are anything but natural matter in the environment. But and some people may have auditory experiences, such as the voice, where these things are a lot more common than a full-body apparition. Full-body apparitions are very, very rare.
Although I did hear a story, it's at a local restaurant in Lancaster County where a server saw a couple, had a young girl, looked like to be about 4 or 5, with blonde hair with them. And a little bit later, she asked where their daughter was. And the couple said, what do you mean? We're here alone. Mm-hmm. And the server said, I saw a little blonde girl with you walking into the restaurant. Said, no, that we don't have anyone with us. So, you know, you hear stories like that.
Yep.
Dr. Absolutely. Robbins, we only have about 45 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We could go on with a lot of stories,
sure.
But on this Halloween, what kind of advice, what kind of information would you give all those out there listening?
I would just say, you know, enjoy the holiday. If you're really interested in the holiday, look up the history of the holiday and why we actually celebrate it and how we've really Americanized it from its Celtic beginnings or Celtic beginnings. But, you know, don't jump to conclusions and be critical. Be a critical thinker when you have such experiences. And, again, I'm not saying they don't happen, and I'm not saying they aren't paranormal, but what I'm saying is you know, take your time, think about things and what might actually be occurring.
Dr. Rich Robbins, Bucknell University, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with Congressman Scott Perry, who is an incumbent running for Congress in the 10th Congressional District. We also talk about why people are so angry and what's going on around this country right now. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.